We are here today for the ITRC soil background and risk assessment document, and we have some great trainers here today with us. Let me get to those. They will be answering your questions as we go through, and they will introduce themselves as they come on screen each time to respond to some of the questions that we have. I do want to say that today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. It is a state-led organization of state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses like the one you are seeing today. On the ITRC website is the full ITR disclaimer. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in full. ITRC is partially funded by the US government, and ITRC nor the US government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. So with that, I want to invite Claudio Sorrentino from the Department of Toxic Substances Control in California to kick us off. Welcome, Claudio.
Thanks, Nicole, and welcome to everybody. This training is in support of the ITRC guidance on soil background and risk assessment that was published in December of last year. And if you haven't done it, Nicole, can you put the link to the document in either the chat or the Q&A, whatever you're using? And I want to remind people that if you have not visited the document, go there, familiarize, because you will have a lot of more details that we can present here today for a matter of time. In addition to the document, the team produced four videos that will be soon available for view on demand that will cover selected topics. And we are going to show two of them today. And the first one, video one, gives a general introduction on the guidance document and goes over some definition and more general topics. And then we are going to a video that will go more deeply on how to establish background and use it in risk assessment. After each of these videos, we'll have a Q&A session, and then the end we'll be taking questions about anything relevant to the document itself. And please keep in mind that there's much more in the guidance that we can say today or can be in the videos. So we are going to start with a soil background and risk assessment overview video, and then we'll come back to work on some question so please feel free to use the Q&A for your questions. Thank you.
Soil background is an important factor to consider when conducting human health and ecological risk assessments. Regulators use numerical screening values specific to contaminants commonly found in soil to evaluate potential risks to people and the environment. For some chemicals, the screening value may be within the range of concentrations found in soils from natural or anthropogenic ambient background. Because most regulatory agencies do not require action to be taken if the amount of a chemical in soil is within the range of background concentrations, soil background plays an important role in remedial decisions. The ITRC Soil Background and Risk Team created four videos to highlight the ITRC 2021 guidance document. Video 1 is the introduction to the soil background and risk assessment guidance. Video 2 cover sampling and analytical methods. Video 3 discusses how to develop default and site-specific background and use them in risk assessment, as well as the development of preliminary remediation goals. Video 4 presents how to use geochemical evaluation and environmental forensics in evaluating background in risk assessments. The soil background and risk guidance and the training videos and training schedules are found on the ITRC website. This video describes the purpose and overall content of the guidance document, presents the key definitions of natural background and anthropogenic ambient background, and discusses some of the limitations. The ITRC guidance document is designed to provide comprehensive guidance regarding establishing and using soil background values in risk assessment. It focuses on the process of establishing defensible background concentrations of naturally occurring chemicals like metals or anthropogenic substances such as PAHs to be used for risk assessment at contaminated sites. The guidance also includes definitions and regulatory framework. This ITRC guidance document recognizes that although some state and federal agencies and other entities have guidance documents regarding soil background, there is not one comprehensive and widely accepted guidance document that summarizes the state of the science on this topic. It is intended to fill the gap by providing a comprehensive, defensible framework for establishing and using soil background in risk assessments. One of the state survey questions asked if state agencies recommend the use of soil background values in risk assessment. Out of 38 state responses, Figure 12-2 from the guidance shows 92% recommended the use of background values in risk assessment. Half of the surveyed states established statewide or regional soil background values for some chemicals, as shown in Figure 12-3. Natural soil background has been defined in multiple federal and state guidance documents. As stated in Section 2.1, natural soil background is defined as the concentration of a substance or family of closely related substances, for example, similar element species or similar compounds, present in soil due to geological characteristics, natural processes, or releases from non-anthropogenic sources. Section 2.1 covers more details and examples of natural background. For example, arsenic is naturally occurring in many soils throughout the United States from rock weathering and other natural processes. In this graphic, the naturally occurring arsenic is represented by the green icons.
For purposes of this document, anthropogenic ambient soil background is defined as the concentration of a substance or family of closely related substances present in soil due to anthropogenic non-point sources, especially when chemicals have the ability to be transported long distances. Other state-specific definitions, applications, and examples of anthropogenic background are detailed in Section 2.2. When establishing anthropogenic ambient soil background, it is important to carefully consider the intended purpose and clearly define anthropogenic ambient soil background to identify which sources should and should not be included in the risk assessment. An example of anthropogenic ambient background is when PAHs are released into the air from many different locations and migrate over far distances and then settle onto the soil. Now, let's talk about how to differentiate between natural background and contamination. PAHs released from non-anthropogenic sources, like forest fires, can be transported long distances and deposited onto and remain persistent in the soil. PAHs released from forest fires are considered natural background.
PAH contamination coming from anthropogenic ambient background are represented by the blue icons. PAH contamination coming from the factory is represented by the orange clouds. This graphic shows how PAH contamination in soil can be mixed with PAHs from anthropogenic ambient sources, as shown in the orange icons.
This animation depicts how arsenic from different sources can impact a site. Arsenic can also be present in soil as a result of contamination. Before World War II, arsenical pesticides were commonly used in apple orchards. Frequently, near loading docks and other storage preparation areas,
this is illustrated by the orange icons.
The background of arsenic is the amount of a substance present in soil due to natural processes, such as weathering. It may be important for project remedial goals to understand how much arsenic is present from background and how much are from site activities. Please note limitations to the ITRC guidance. It is not intended to provide specific soil background values for chemicals. However, it is intended to support risk-based decision-making and complement, not replace, existing regulatory guidance. It is important to keep in mind to review the regulatory framework and the policies of the lead agency to understand their requirements. The guidance does not provide in-depth details for sampling and analytical methods, statistics, geochemistry, and forensics. This is a general introduction to the 2021 ITRC guidance document, Soil Background and Risk Assessment. There are 3 additional videos in this series. For specific topics, refer to the individual sections or other videos in this series, and please visit itrcweb.org for more information.
Great, so thank you for everybody for the audio challenges, and hopefully that fixed it throughout the video. I think we're going to start with a couple of questions while we just get ourselves oriented here. So Claudio, do you mind if I start with you, pick on you first here with the first question that we've received? And it was that.
Go ahead.
Great. Does the ITRC guidance document address soil background and risk assessment under CERCLA specifically?
Well, not specifically under CERCLA. This is a general guidance that is meant to apply nationwide. So we talk about CERCLA in, let me check, section 4.3.5. But again, there is some information there, but I would encourage you to check with the regulators, because these are general concepts, and each individual, either a federal or a state regulator or local regulator, may have different things that apply specifically for your site. So there is something about CERCLA, but again, this guidance is more general, and check with your own regulator.
Great. Thanks, Claudio. Brady, I'm going to pick on you next. Is a local point source with wide impacts, such as deposition from a power plant or smelter, included in the guidance definition of anthropogenic ambient background?
Sure. So as we kind of touched on the video, so the definition that we use within the guidance excludes local sources and really only includes widespread diffuse sources that are expected to be uniform across like an entire region. So that was kind of the framework that we used in the guidance to be able to discuss these types of issues. So different regulatory agencies may have their own definition of anthropogenic ambient background. In some cases, it could be appropriate to include those local sources. I think most important, you should really try to figure out your goals for the site and what your regulatory agency allows as far as including an anthropogenic ambient background, and then decide how you should define that for your own site-specific location.
Great. Thanks, Brady. For those of you just joining us, we have just shared the first video from the SBR team that was developed as an overview of the soil background and risk guidance document. I am going to pause here, and we are going to start video 3 for you to review. I'm going to pause it halfway through. It is about 24 minutes long total, and I will remind you that you do have a Q&A pod at the bottom, and we welcome any questions throughout the presentation. So please feel free to use that Q&A pod, and give me a moment and I will start our next video. Thank you.
Soil background is an important factor to consider when conducting human health and ecological risk assessments. Regulators use numerical screening values specific to contaminants commonly found in soil to evaluate potential risks to people and the environment. For some chemicals, the screening value may be within the range of concentrations found in soils from natural or anthropogenic ambient background, because most regulatory agencies do not require action to be taken if the amount of a chemical in soil is within the range of background concentration. Soil background plays an important role in remedial decisions. This is the third video for the Soil Background in Risk Assessment Guidance Document Training. This video will provide an overview of the following topics: the differences and similarities between default and site-specific background, how to use default background in risk assessment. Site-specific background and how it's used in risk assessment will then be discussed. Use of soil background to develop preliminary remedial goals will be presented. We will use a case study to demonstrate how to use soil background in risk assessments. The Soil Background and Risk Assessment Guidance can be found on the ITRC website. All training videos are also available on the ITRC website. As a note of caution, while statistics are an important part of the evaluation of a background condition, we are not going to go into a step-by-step discussion on how to perform various statistical evaluations. We will do a high-level summary of what you need to know regarding how statistics may be used in the evaluation of soil background data in risk assessment. More information on how to perform statistics when evaluating soil background is available in Section 11 of the ITRC guidance document. Before we dive in, there are a few things to know. This symbol indicates that we will be discussing a disclaimer or caution. The first caution is to ensure you know the regulatory agency you are working under. Each regulatory agency, be it federal, state, or local, has their own definitions for soil background. Each regulatory agency has their own set of processes and requirements. It is important to coordinate with the regulatory agency you are working under at the start of your project. So remember, check with your regulator first. Let's start with defining default and site-specific background. Default background is generally established by regulatory agencies for larger areas like a state, region, or a unique geological area. A large number of sites located within that area are evaluated using default background to determine if those individual site concentrations are representative of background. For example, many states have developed statewide or regional background values that are used to compare to concentrations from sites that are located in those states or regions. Therefore, default background represents a large number of sites. Site-specific background is generally established by a responsible or voluntary party for one specific site or a few sites. This type of background is more specialized based on the characteristics of a specific site or a few sites in a smaller geographical area. Both default and site-specific background are established using areas that are similar in physical, chemical, geological, and biological characteristics to the site or sites being evaluated. Remember, the difference is that default background is compared to a large number of sites, whereas site-specific background is used to compare to one or a few sites. This means that the area used to represent default background should be generally, and I emphasize generally, similar to all of the many sites that will be evaluated against it, and the area used to represent site-specific background should be more closely, and I emphasize more closely, similar to the one site or a few sites that it will be compared against. Because default background is intended to be used for a large number of sites in a large geographical area, it is generally established to be more conservative. Site-specific background is considered more accurate because it uses information specific to one or a few sites which has a more limited geographical area. Both default and site-specific background can be established for natural and anthropogenic ambient background. Default soil background can be used as a screening tool to determine if contaminant concentrations are generally representative of background concentrations. This is typically done by using a default background threshold value, or a BTV, that is established by a regulatory agency. Default BTVs are compared to site concentrations to determine if the site concentrations represent background. If they do, most regulatory agencies will not require further evaluation. If they do not, regulatory agencies will require further evaluation. If you still think your site concentrations represent background, one option to evaluate further is to establish site-specific background. Please refer to the guidance for more information regarding how to establish default BTVs. Site-specific soil background can be used to establish site-specific soil BTVs and can also be used to compare the site-specific soil background dataset to the site dataset. The use of a site-specific BTV allows you to identify localized contamination. This is most commonly done by comparing the site-specific BTV to each site soil concentration by way of a point-by-point comparison. Comparing the site-specific background dataset to the site dataset using a statistical test allows you to identify slight but pervasive contamination. Regulatory agencies vary regarding what they require. Some do not have default BTVs, and some that do may not have default BTVs for all contaminants. In these cases, some regulatory agencies require you to establish site-specific background. Remember, discuss the use of background data in the risk assessment with the regulatory agency early in the process. Default and site-specific soil background may be established either from an existing soil background study or by conducting a new soil background study. Conducting a new soil background study is the preferred method because this allows you to make sure the study meets your specific goals. Section 9 of the guidance document and Video 2 have more information.
All right, welcome back, folks. We're going to pause it before we get into our case study of the second part of the video and answer some of the questions that we have been asked. So I'm going to have Brady Grape come on. And we had a question: is incremental sampling an appropriate methodology to use to establish soil background?
Thanks, Squid. Yeah, so incremental sampling, we do discuss that a little bit within the guidance in section 9. It's also briefly touched on in one of the videos that we won't be viewing here today, but will be part of the series. So incremental sampling provides a very good estimate of the mean as far as your samples. It reduces the variability in your data, which means you can get good estimates of the mean with less samples. But as far as for establishing soil background, kind of the downside of that is those results generally aren't comparable to discrete samples that you have on the sites because it is more of a mean concentration. And those discrete samples that you may already have at your site would need to be excluded from any statistical analysis that uses ISM. Also, kind of something to think about when establishing soil background, those ISMs, as we said, they represent an average. So that data isn't appropriate to compare to a background threshold value, which is more of a discrete sample measure. And also, ISM is still kind of up in the air with some regulators. So that would be something that you would have to look at too.
Great. Thanks for all that information. How about we hear from Charlie for the next question with how many background samples are required to establish soil background? And what depths of soil sampling are recommended to establish soil background?
Thanks, Nicole. This is the million-dollar question, right? It's the question that everybody wants to know. And I'm sorry to say that there's no default answer that we can give you that's a specific number. The answer really is that it depends on your sampling strategy. And your sampling strategy, it's actually discussed in section 9 of the guidance, but your strategy flows from your CSM and your data quality objectives, right? You want to make sure that you know what data you're going to get and what you're going to use it for, and that's all part of your sort of sampling design and strategy. Some general ideas, I guess, is that you want to, you know, choose areas that are appropriately representative for background, and you may have more than one, so that's something to consider. The areas need to be as similar as possible in physical, chemical, geological, biological, ecological characteristics to your site that you're going to evaluate against it. And you want to avoid areas that are impacted by local sources. With respect to sample numbers specifically, the guidance does point to a couple tools that can be used to establish limits on how many samples you might need. Visual sampling plan is one, ProUCL is another, and they're helpful, but also professional judgment is ultimately involved. So I don't know if anybody else has any comments they want to make.
Hey, yeah, Charlie, that was great information. This is Karen. I'll just add that you want to make sure that you're using similar sample depths for your background reference area samples as those that you're using at your site, so that your site and background samples were collected from similar depths. The question of the appropriate depth to sample at your site is a risk assessment exposure question, and that is out of scope for this document.
I would like to chime in on the previous question, and I just want to remind people that there is also another ITRC document, the update to the ISM guidance that talks about ISM and its use to calculate soil background, in which they go a little more in detail than what we did. And I'm going to put the link of the specific section in the chat.
Yeah, Claudio, and I'll also add, since our soil background and risk assessment guidance covers geochemical evaluations of metals, if you plan to perform a geochemical evaluation, you will need discrete sample data, and you really can't use incremental samples for those kinds of evaluations.
Great, great extra information there for folks. And Claudio, thank you for the link. Let's take one more question here. And Chrissy, I think that we'll call on you for the first time today. How do you address naturally occurring elements such as arsenic as background when the concentrations exceed risk assessment thresholds?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Nicole. That is that's a great question. Honestly, I think actually we should use the remaining portion of video 3 and the case study that's presented there to help answer this question. And then after the video, at some point, I think Bonnie will walk through some flow charts that might also provide some more insight.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Chrissy. So I think with that, we'll pause. Thank you for those that are using the Q&A pod. We will continue to review the questions and add them to our queue here. I'm going to pause again, and we will finish with video 3, and then we'll come back to answer some more questions.
Specific soil background and risk assessment. This case study does not encompass everything within the ITRC guidance document, and some steps may not be applicable to the regulatory agency you are working with. As you can see, there is a facility located in a rural area. East of the facility is vacant land with a stream. Woods and vegetation in this area are similar to that in the facility, and the predominant wind direction is from the east to the west. We'll use this scenario to discuss how to use default and site-specific background in risk assessment. During site characterization, releases from historical operations at the facility were identified. Soil samples were collected at the site, and inorganic and organic contaminants were detected. Site concentrations of some inorganics and organics exceeded their applicable risk-based soil screening values. Arsenic, cobalt, iron, and vanadium are the inorganics. Dioxins and carcinogenic polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or also known as CPAHs, are the organics. Since we think that these concentrations are representative of both natural and anthropogenic ambient background, we decided to evaluate background soil concentrations. We checked with the regulatory agency to see if it had default BTVs. And if you recall, those are background threshold values established to be compared to a large number of sites and used to screen. Since statewide default background values were available, we started by using default BTVs to compare to our site concentrations. Some states may also have regional background data sets. Now we need to make sure that the default BTVs were applicable to our site, so we compared some key characteristics. The default BTV was representative of rural areas, which is where our site was located. And rural areas following wildfires can have higher background concentrations of CPAHs and dioxins. Urban areas can have higher contaminant anthropogenic ambient background concentrations than rural areas. It is also important to note that regulatory agencies define this type of background differently. We didn't identify any site conditions indicating unique geology or mineralogy. It is especially important to consider unique geology and mineralogy at mining sites, where it can be expected that site-specific background for some metals may be necessary. The scope of the default BTVs identified for our site was any sites within the state. As our site was in that state, this fit within the geographic extent of the background study. We also considered some additional items to determine whether it was appropriate to use the default BTV. There were no regional anthropogenic sources, which may not be apparent in a statewide background data set. There were no unique conditions at the site, such as shallow groundwater. Shallow groundwater can impact solubility of some compounds, which in turn may affect background concentrations. Therefore, depth of groundwater should also be considered when reviewing applicability of background data sets. The sample collection methods were similar in the background study to those used at the site. They both used discrete sampling. The analytical methods used were similar, and this included both extraction methods and analysis methods. One important note is that USGS and USEPA analytical methods for inorganics differ and may provide different results. USGS is a total method and in most cases will result in higher concentration than USEPA's methods. If USGS data are used to establish a default BTV, that BTV may not appropriately represent background. This may result in a BTV that is higher than it would be if it were established using results from USEPA's analytical method. Therefore, using a BTV based on USGS's data may not be adequately protective of potential site risks. Please refer to the guidance document for additional information regarding different analysis methods. Now that we know that the default BTV the regulatory agency recommended is appropriate for our site, we need to compare it to our site data. Default BTVs are a single upper bound value. We wanted to make sure we understood the calculations used to develop this value. For example, there are many upper bound statistical values that could be selected, upper prediction limits, upper tolerance limits, and others as discussed in Section 11 of the guidance document. For our case study, the default BTV was calculated using USEPA's ProUCL and was based on 112 samples across the state. The BTV is a 95-95 upper tolerance limit, or a 95-95 UTL, which means it represents the 95th percent upper confidence limit on the 95th percentile. All of the contaminant concentrations were compared to the default BTV to determine if any exceeded, and if so, how many and by what magnitude. This type of comparison is often referred to as a point-by-point comparison. If all of the site concentrations, or one could say if the maximum site concentration, are less than the default BTV, site conditions are considered to represent background. If some of the site concentrations exceed the default BTV, additional evaluations comparing the site data set to the default BTV are generally useful before moving into the next step. These additional evaluations include graphical comparisons, spatial comparisons, and the test for proportions. Please refer to Section 11 of the Guidance Manual for additional information on these additional evaluations. In our case study, site concentrations of iron, as well as the maximum site iron concentration, were below default BTVs. For all of the other inorganics and organics, some site concentrations exceeded the BTV even after the additional evaluation was performed. Therefore, iron concentrations at the site were considered to represent background. Arsenic, cobalt, vanadium, CPAHs, and dioxins were carried forward into the site-specific background evaluation. Remember, site-specific background levels are generally established by a responsible party or voluntary party for a smaller area than default background studies. They are established for one or a few specific sites and therefore more accurately represent that site or those sites. They can also be established for both natural and anthropogenic ambient background conditions. Site-specific background may be needed when site concentrations exceed default background, when default background values for the chemical are either not available or not appropriate to use. For example, default background data sets do not have the same physical, chemical, geological, or biological characteristics as the site. They may also be needed when it is a specific type of site that default background may not apply to, for example, a mining site, or when a more refined evaluation is needed, even if a default background level is available. Site-specific background takes into consideration the soil present at your site. It uses site-specific information to establish soil background. When conducting a site-specific risk assessment, site-specific soil risk-based values are generally derived as a first step, since they are often less conservative than default soil risk-based values and may be less conservative than soil background. For our case study, site concentrations exceeded their applicable site-specific risk-based soil values. Therefore, a site-specific soil background evaluation was necessary. First, we determined an area suitable to use to represent site-specific background. We identified areas around the facility that were unimpacted by facility operations. Remember, you may need to expand your footprint outside of the immediate vicinity to identify appropriate background study area for your site. Here we identified the wooded area east of the facility, which had vacant land with a stream and with similar woods and vegetation as the facility. Also, it is located upwind of the facility and it's undeveloped. We investigated the history of this area to make sure that there were no known sources of contamination. For our case study, the area east of the creek, but not in the mountains, contained similar characteristics as site soils. Once we identified this area closely represented the site being evaluated in physical, chemical, geological, and biological characteristics, we needed to identify specific locations to sample. For more information on sample design for a background study, please refer to video 2. The number of samples to be collected may vary and is dependent upon other considerations. Here we determined that 30 samples were sufficient. We chose locations that were least likely to be impacted by the facility and by specific sources. We analyzed for arsenic, cobalt, vanadium, CPAHs, and dioxins. Then, we used ProUCL software to establish site-specific BTVs and used hypothesis testing to compare the site-specific background dataset to the site datasets for each contaminant. Make sure you consider the various options available, UTL versus USL versus UPL, and pick the most appropriate one to use. Hypothesis testing is also used to compare the entire site-specific background dataset to the site dataset. US EPA's ProUCL software is commonly used to accomplish this step, but other software could be used. Please refer to Section 11, Table 11-5 of the ITRC guidance document for details on the different hypothesis tests, including advantages and disadvantages. Similar to what was done with the default BTV, all of the contaminant concentrations were compared to the site-specific BTV to determine if any exceeded, and if so, how many and by what magnitude. The use of a site-specific BTV allows you to identify localized contamination. This type of comparison is often referred to as a point-by-point comparison. If all of the site concentrations or the maximum site concentration are less than the site-specific BTV, site conditions are considered to represent background. If some site concentrations exceed the site-specific BTV, additional evaluations comparing the site data set to the site-specific BTV are generally useful. These additional evaluations include graphical and spatial comparisons and the test for proportions. Please refer to Section 11 of the Guidance Manual for information on these additional evaluations. Next, we compared the central tendencies of the site and background data sets using a two-sample hypothesis statistical test. In this case, we used ProUCL software to perform the students' t-test. By comparing their central tendencies and variances, it is possible to identify if there may be slight but pervasive contamination. As stated earlier, please refer to Section 11, Table 11.5 of the guidance document for details on the different hypothesis tests, including advantages and disadvantages. Upper bound and central tendency comparisons complement each other and are not an either-or situation. As you can see, the maximum concentration of vanadium at the site is lower than the BTV value. The student's t-test suggests that vanadium at the site is considered to represent site-specific background levels. Therefore, it does not get carried forward in the risk assessment. Arsenic, cobalt, CPHs, and dioxins get carried forward into the next step of the process, which is the geochemical and environmental forensics assessment. Geochemical evaluations and environmental forensics are often underutilized in human health and ecological risk assessments of soils. However, they can be useful tools in determining whether observed chemical concentrations in site soils may be representative of natural or anthropogenic ambient background. We will not go into detail about how to perform geochemical evaluations and environmental forensics in this training, since they are covered in Video 4 and in the guidance in Sections 5, 6, and 7. It is important to note that these evaluations should only be performed by experienced geochemists and geologists. As a result of the geochemical evaluation, cobalt was found to be representative of background. As a result of the environmental forensics evaluation, CPAHs were found to be representative of the soil background condition. Arsenic and dioxins were not found to be representative of the background condition. Therefore, these chemicals will be carried into the remedial goals selection process. As we begin to select remedial goals for the remaining chemicals in our case study, a quick reminder is to know your regulatory agency. Each agency has their own definitions, requirements, and processes that may differ slightly from the training and the guidance. Typically, when site conditions are associated with unacceptable risks, regulatory agencies will require further action, which might include a response action, and that would include a remedial goal. In some cases, it is reasonable to use soil background as the remedial goal. There are two ways to use soil background to set a remedial goal. Use a default or site-specific BTV, or compare the soil background data set to the site data set to determine whether areas may require a response action. Default or site-specific BTVs may be based on central tendency or upper limit values. This choice is a risk management decision rather than a risk assessment decision. Using a central tendency BTV as a remedial goal is a more conservative approach than using an upper limit BTV. But it is also more likely to result in false positive errors or concluding that a soil sample is contaminated when it represents background. Using an upper limit BTV may be more susceptible to false negative errors or concluding a soil sample is not contaminated when it actually is contaminated. It is important to ensure that both the BTV and site concentration are of the same type of statistics. For example, if a central tendency BTV is used as the remedial goal, then the site concentration for comparison should also be a central tendency. As we saw, arsenic and dioxin were not found to be representative of soil background. These chemicals will need to be addressed as part of the remedial action. For this case study, we used the 95-95 upper tolerance limits, or UTLs, that we established during the site-specific risk assessment as remedial goals. The responsible party cleaned up all the areas where soil, arsenic, or dioxin concentrations exceeded the 95-95 UTL. This concludes our training on default and site-specific background. For information on these topics, as well as the guidance and other training videos, visit the ITRC website.
The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a non.
All right, welcome back. And thank you for sitting with us, the case study, and for Chrissy for walking us through that. Bonnie, I'm going to pull up your flow charts here from the guidance document and ask you, how can you differentiate between background concentrations and a release?
Yeah, absolutely. Once the flow charts come up, I will walk us through the process. So we have three different flowcharts that we included as part of the guidance. We have two that regard how to establish background, one's on default and one's on site specific. And then we have another flowchart that tells you how to use soil background and risk assessment. This first flowchart is establishing default soil background. And when you establish default soil background, you come up with a background threshold value, or also known as a BTV. And I won't get into a lot of detail about this, but basically you can either conduct a soil study yourself, which is usually the preferred method, or you can use an existing soil study. If your existing soil study is not generally similar to the multiple sites that you're going to be evaluating for default background, then you can adjust it if that's possible. If you can't adjust it, then you're going to need to conduct the soil study. You need to make sure that that soil study that you conduct and that you design is going to be generally similar to all of the sites that you're going to be evaluating against it. And you're going to do this by defining the study area. You'll need to do some sampling, laboratory analysis, and then, of course, statistics to actually establish that default BTV or background threshold value. And then you'll use that default BTV in the screening risk assessment step. Next slide, please, Nicole. So the second flowchart that we have is how to establish site-specific soil background. And the difference here is when you establish site-specific soil background, you're doing it for a specific site, or sometimes it could be a couple specific sites. And you end up with a site-specific data set that you can compare to your site data set. And you also end up with a site-specific background threshold value, or BTV. The process, a lot of it is the same. You're just using site-specific things in this process. So again, you can conduct that soil study, or you can use an existing soil study. If there's no way to compensate, if that study isn't as similar to your site as it needs to be, then you'll need to conduct the soil study, go through the same process. And what you end up with is a site-specific background data set that you'll use in a site-specific risk assessment. And you also end up with a site-specific background threshold value, or BTV, that you can also use in that site-specific risk assessment. Next slide, please, Nicole. And the third flowchart is how to use soil background and risk assessment. So the first step for this is to do a screening risk assessment. Generally, that's the first step. And then you take your site concentrations, compare them to the risk-based soil screening values, or in some cases, you might have a default BTV. If you pass that, then you don't need to do anything. If you don't pass that screening, then you move into the site-specific risk assessment. And the first step normally in a site-specific risk assessment is to take those site concentrations and compare them to site-specific risk-based soil values. And again, if you pass, that's great. No further action. If you don't, then that's the time where you look at site-specific soil background. If you pass that site-specific soil background, if your site concentrations are less than the site-specific soil background, you don't need to go any further. But if you don't, then you know that further action is needed, and you should definitely consider background for remedial goals. Now, as part of this, you'll see there's a big chunk I haven't talked about yet on the left-hand side, geochemical evaluations and environmental forensics. They can be used at any step in this process. It's just that they're generally used at the site-specific risk assessment step just due to the expertise that's needed and the resources that it takes. And I am in no way an expert on these two, so I am going to let Karen talk about geochemical evaluations And Charlie is going to talk about environmental forensics.
Thanks, Bonnie. In brief, very brief, geochemical evaluations are based in part on selected elemental ratios, and we use them to identify the processes controlling element concentrations in soil and to confirm or rule out the presence of contamination in individual soil samples. And these ratios, these elemental ratios, reflect trace elements affinities to adsorb on the surfaces of specific minerals in soil. And the ratios are generally consistent in a set of uncontaminated samples. An anomalously high ratio can indicate the presence of excess trace element from a contaminant source. So these geochemical evaluations are helpful during background studies because they help us characterize representative background concentrations and conditions. In the SBR guidance, Section 5 describes these evaluations in some detail, and it explains how to use them to identify the processes controlling concentrations, identify contaminated samples, determine whether statistical outliers should be retained or excluded from your background data set, and to confirm whether subgroups of data sets can be combined. Section 6 of the guidance describes how to apply the results of a geochemical evaluation during risk assessment. And then Section 14 provides a bunch of case studies, and a few of those case studies include geochemical evaluations using real-world data. And video 4 in this series covers geochemical evaluations and environmental forensics. We don't have time for that video today, but Charlie can talk more about environmental forensics.
Sure. Thanks, Karen. So with environmental forensics, as we've conceptualized it in the guidance, is that we are looking at organic compounds. I mean, you can think of environmental forensics broadly, which would include looking at sources of metals, but we've really focused on geochemical evaluations for metals and environmental forensics for organic compounds. And the guidance really focuses on PAHs. And the short answer to how you differentiate background concentrations and a release in dealing with organic compounds, PAHs and specifically, is that you develop a sampling design up front that characterizes the difference in chemical signatures, which may be attributed to sources or different fate and transport properties. And with PAHs, you look at things like petrogenic versus pyrogenic signatures, relative abundance of low molecular weight, high molecular weight PAHs, and you look at perhaps alkyl homolog groups, and diagnostic ratios between key PAHs. One of the cool things about the guidance is that there is an appendix which has references to a lot of different studies on PAH, environmental forensics involving PAHs. So it's a good resource for that. And also there's a case study 14.7. It provides a good example of characterizing pH chemical signatures in an effort to distinguish background from site-related PAHs. The sort of bottom line here is that, getting back to this flowchart, that the point in the risk assessment process where you are really applying these techniques is quite deep into the risk assessment process. When you're doing a site-specific risk assessment and you already know that you have concentrations that are above your risk-based criteria. And you, on the other hand, you need to have data up front, right? So you need to sort of balance this need to plan for the potential that you'd need to evaluate organic compounds later on with the need to sample early and to do that cost effectively. So that requires some skill. Anyways, that's all I got.
Thanks, everybody, and hopefully you can all find the guidance document link back in the chat from the very beginning of the call, the webinar, and you can find those flowcharts. Moving on to some other questions, and again, I'll remind folks, please continue to use the Q&A pod. We are getting a lot of questions and working on getting those responded to for you. If a state does not have specific background soil concentrations, for specific contaminants? Are there national or regional default values to consider?
Hey, this is Christy. I think I'll take a stab at that. So the answer would be that there may be. Section 13 of the guidance does have a list of existing studies and also existing guidance that you might find useful. Within this, there are two tables that provide information on the studies themselves and guidance from various entities. And one example of an existing study that might be appropriate to use would be US EPA Region 4's Southeastern States Urban Background Study. And that study was developed by the EPA as a regional data set to be representative of anthropogenic urban background concentrations. And there is a write-up in the guidance that gives you a little more detail about the study, so you can figure out if it would be something that would be applicable for you to use as background. And then I think, Nicole, if you haven't already, could you place a link there in the chat box to that study?
All set. Thanks, Chrissy.
Thanks.
And I just wanted to say that there is a USGS soil study that a lot of you probably are familiar with. I think it was completed around 2007 to 2010. And they sampled some areas in every single state. And they compiled this data set. And upon looking at it, you would think, oh, that's really great. We could use that, right? But you really should be careful before you go and use that to represent background, because USGS uses a very different method, an analytical method, than we would use on a cleanup site. We use EPA's method. Their method ends up being a lot more rigorous. They use a different digestion method, a different preparation method, and it's a more total method. So their concentrations end up being higher. If you compare those higher concentrations to the concentrations at your site using EPA's method, you're going to be underprotective. Now, it varies, but depending on your local geology and depending on the chemical, and there's no simple ratio. So it's not really easy to work with. But when I worked at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, right now I'm in Washington, state of Washington's ecology, we reanalyzed a subset of the samples that USGS took from the state of Minnesota. And if you're interested in finding out a little bit more about that, that's how we established the soil background values. There's a case study in section 14 of the guidance. And also, Nicole, if you don't mind, if you could put in the chat box, looks like you already did it, the guidance for Minnesota. Thanks.
Yeah, great. Thanks, everybody. Let's keep going because I want to try to get through as many questions as we can. So Brady, I'm going to target you for this next one, and we'll see who else might want to tag on to it. But what is the difference between the different potential statistics that could be used to represent a background threshold value? And what type of statistics do you recommend using for developing soil background threshold values?
Cool. Yeah. There's a lot in there. So maybe I'll take the first one and then we can kick it to Chrissy or someone else that wants to take the rest. But as far as different potential statistics, you know, the background threshold values that we have are usually intended to be upper threshold values and not averages. We typically wouldn't want to establish a background threshold value using an average statistic. And you certainly wouldn't want to compare any discrete samples to an average value or an average value to an upper threshold BTV. So we do discuss this in section 11 in the guidance, and we have a table that describes some of those different BTVs. Just real briefly, and this has come up in some of the questions too, so we have upper percentiles. So an upper percentile is going to be a value which below which a specified percentage of your observed background samples would fall. So this would be, you know, containing 95% of your observed values. We also have UCL, or upper confidence limit. These and the rest of them we'll discuss are usually have some assumed distribution, which means we're making some assumptions greater than just our samples, but over our overall site population. So with a confidence limit, the upper limit of that, you have a, say like a 95% confidence interval. It's the upper limit for some parameter. The upper prediction limit is another one, although it's typically used more in, say, groundwater sampling. But that is some value below which a specified number of future independent measurements will fall. That has to be something that's defined previous before you actually do your sampling. We have an upper tolerance limit, or UTL, which we discussed in the videos. And that's simply calculating upper confidence limit on a percentile of your population, which is your observed current or future values. Another one, kind of less commonly seen, is USL, or upper simultaneous limit. And that's just a value below which the largest value of your background population will fall at, again, whatever your specified confidence is. Yeah, maybe Chrissy, do you want to take the second part about recommendations?
Sure. So the guidance doesn't recommend one specific type of statistics that should be used in all cases to establish the soil background value. And it really does depend on your specific situation. If you're establishing a default soil background threshold value, or BTB, the UTL, or upper tolerance limit, is generally used, since it results in the least amount of false negatives or false positives when making comparisons to a large number of sites. BTVs based on a upper simultaneous limit, or USL, would result in a higher number of false negatives. So meaning that samples that are a result of contamination would appear as if they are not. BTVs based on upper percentiles or upper confidence limits result in a high number of false positive error rates. And that means that samples that are not a result of contamination would appear as if they are. And I do also just want to add a note that the UCL of the mean, that's a specific type of UCL that, you know, we as risk assessors commonly think of when you hear UCL, and or at least I know that I do. And the UCL of the mean is a representation of the central tendency of a data set, and that's not really appropriate to use as the BTB or compare that value to BTB, because the BTB is an upper bound estimate.
Great. Thanks to you both for providing your perspective and response to that question. That was a big one. I'm going to jump over here to one. It says, has there been any discussion of PFAS as potential anthropogenic ambient background contaminants?
Do you want me to take that to start?
Would love to.
There is, in the guidance, in Section 7 on environmental forensics, it goes through the different chemical groups that sort of are amenable. These are organic chemical groups that are amenable to environmental forensics. And the general idea is that they have, you know, these groups have generally similar chemical properties, but subtle differences due to subtle differences in their chemical structure that would partition them in the environment or partition them in their sources, right? And the guidance focuses on PAHs and PCBs and dioxins and furans. And there is a short section on PFAS, and sort of the same conceptual approaches that are used for PAHs that are discussed in the guidance could be applied to PFAS, but we don't go into tremendous detail. And the truth is that there was a lot of advance in our understanding of PFAS, a lot going on. It's an active area of research. And a lot was going on while we were putting together this guidance. The ITRC also has a working group which is working on PFAS specifically. So I guess that's my answer to that. Anybody else?
Great job, Charlie. Thank you. Charlie, since you volunteered for the last one, I'm going to pick on you again. What techniques can I use to distinguish background from site-related organic compound concentrations?
Yeah, well, I think this is pretty much the same answer that I just gave, right? That if you have groups of chemical compounds that have very similar structures, very similar chemical behavior, but subtle differences that could reflect their sources or their fate and transport, then those different subtle differences can be used to distinguish between different sources, one of which could be a background source. So typically for PAHs, particulates and sort of pyrogenic sources are associated with background. And if you have a sampling strategy that allows you to, you know, you're sampling an area that would be impacted by background only, and you can compare that to an area that was sampled for, say, hydrocarbon or petroleum release, you can use those general principles to separate those two sources. Through the use of things like diagnostic ratios, full patterns, where you have a large number of the individual chemicals that you're looking at, alkyl groups versus parent PAHs, those kinds of things. And like I said, those same general concepts can be applied to the other chemical groups.
Thanks. That was great. Excellent information being shared here today. Okay, let's see. How about we go? So we're going to be looking at an agricultural area that may have had lead arsenate use. Is use of ISM applicable for investigating if the expected molar ratio of arsenic to lead is indicative of potential use of lead arsenate or lack thereof?
This is Karen. I'll answer that question. In general, and also the SBR guidance recommends using discrete samples, not incremental samples, for geochemical evaluation. And this question essentially pertains to geochemical evaluation of lead and arsenic in soil. And that's because we do want to identify anomalous ratios. I have evaluated a lead arsenate impacted site several years ago, and that was based on discrete samples. And arsenic has a strong affinity to adsorbent iron oxides, so we tend to see covariance of arsenic and iron concentrations in uncontaminated samples. That flies out the window when you've added arsenic as a contaminant. The arsenic iron ratios increase in impacted samples. If you've added lead, the lead aluminum ratios, if lead is associated with clays, the lead aluminum ratios will be elevated. Lead can also adsorb on iron oxides. So the problem with looking at just at lead and arsenic is that lead and arsenic, in the case of lead arsenate contamination, can be co-contaminants. So they can co-vary. They can have a similar constant ratio, indicative of both association with mineral and due to their contaminant status. All that to say this, when you are using incremental soil data, attempting to use it in a geochemical evaluation, the extreme compositing that is performed to acquire your incremental data will serve to normalize your concentrations, normalize your ratios, and it makes it very hard to identify impacted samples, to identify the anomalous ratios. So this is best done with discrete samples where the natural variability is readily seen and individually impacted samples are readily observed. So that's my rough off-the-cuff answer to that question.
Great, thanks, Karen.
Karen, please consider that there was also an immediate follow-up to the question from Karen DiBiasio, and it was, of course, this would be after considering whether arsenic and lead are representative of background or not. I don't know if that would change at all your answer.
And assuming we have a background data set that was analyzed for arsenic and lead and the major elements, as well as site data samples that were analyzed for lead and arsenic and the major elements, then we can compare the ratios. But again, I mean, even if we're talking about incremental background and incremental site samples, we have really obscured the natural signal inherent in the data by compositing to that extreme. And so it just makes it very much more difficult to identify impacted site samples, even if we have a background data set. and I've seen this because I actually have attempted geochemical evaluation using incremental data. It is just not recommended.
Excellent. Great. Thanks, Claudia, for clarifying that second part of the question. Brady, can you calculate a BTV with ISM data?
Okay. So that kind of goes along with what Karen was discussing in that last one. So, I mean, the thing with ISM is, it represents a physical average of the data. So if we did calculate a BTV from that, it's really not going to be representative of, say, like the upper tails of our data set or our population, because we're reducing it to this average or a mean concentration. So generally, it would say, no, it's not recommended to do that just on ISM is more of an average value.
Thanks, Brady. Can I use data from impacted sites to calculate background threshold values? Bonnie, do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. So generally, no. The goal is to establish background using areas that are not impacted by local releases and using those methods that we talked about earlier. But there is a section in the guidance, section 3.9, extracting site-specific background data sets from on-site data. And it shows an iterative graphical approach to use on-site data to get background. But this is something that comes with a lot of caution and a lot of disclaimers. EPA has used this on some sites, but one thing that's really important to remember is you have to have a very expert statistician who's very experienced in not only statistics, but also working with cleanup site data. It also requires that you have many years of data and large sets of data. So it's really only something that should be used as a last resort.
Yeah, I just want to kind of pop in on one last thing there too. I agree with everything that Bonnie said there, and we do provide some methodology to go through that if it is something that you have to do. It's pretty general, it involves some univariate statistics like looking at box plots and QQ plots, a kind of brief touch on multivariate methods like principal component analysis. That can possibly allow you to identify multiple populations at the site. Again, possibly. As Bonnie said, it's best if you have an abundance of data to your site. You still need to take into consideration how the samples were collected, the soils, the geology, whether your sampling plans were totally random, or if you have some targeted data where you're, really focusing on areas with contamination. And the process overall is very, very iterative and involved for all the stakeholders as far as looking at these plots, trying to identify populations. And there's a lot of back and forth that could be from specific sites down to specific metals or contaminants that you're looking at. So it is very detailed.
Yeah, and to that I would add that sometimes QQ plots and multivariate methods are inconclusive or possibly inappropriate for several reasons. I have extracted background data for a few sites in the past, and those methods weren't useful. But for metals, shameless plug, a geochemical evaluation can be performed to identify impacted samples that you should include exclude from your candidate background data set, and then to identify unimpacted samples that can be included as background.
Great, thanks. Some of my favorite questions are when the multiple trainers can provide their point of view, so thank you. I will note that we have a lot of questions out here. We are not going to make it through all of them, but we are working through them as best we can. Next question here is, when establishing background values for multiple contaminants at a site, is it important to use a consistent statistic for all contaminants, or are there cases where it may make sense to select different statistics for different contaminants?
Hey, so this is Chrissy again. I think that, you know, when you're selecting your statistics, that the data sets will vary for the different constituents potentially, and that you want to make sure that that the statistic that you're selecting fits the data set and is appropriate, and that you're also, when you're comparing that value to your data set, that you're comparing similar statistics. So, you know, similar upper bound statistics.
Great. Thanks, Chrissy, for that. All right, jumping around, we got some more coming in. Bonnie, I'm going to tee you up here. Is ITRC developing guidance for establishing background for groundwater and its applications in risk assessment?
Oh, yep, sure. No, ITRC is not at this time because they do not have a proposal that's been submitted to do so. But I work for Washington Department of Ecology, and we did derive a background value for arsenic and groundwater. Charles San Juan did that. If anybody's interested in that, definitely email me, or you can look it up on our website. I can get you in touch with Charles, who I'm sure would be happy to talk that over with you.
I'll put in another plug for agency. So I'm with the state of Idaho. We do have a guidance for determining background groundwater quality. It does not list values, just because aquifers across the state, you know, they've changed so much that it's very difficult to determine background statewide or even for an aquifer. But we do have a guidance up on our website. It's currently being revised. But we include discussion about how you would look at hydrogeologic data, considerations, and statistical methods. And I mean, honestly, the statistical methods are pretty similar to soil. We kind of have the same types of values, but that guidance is up on our website. And if anybody has questions about that specifically, feel free to reach out to me and I can send that over to you.
This is Karen. Yeah, I'll just add a note of caution that metals behavior in groundwater is more complex than in soil, because the effects of redox and pH are more pronounced, and there are more geochemical processes to consider. And that's fine, as long as you have the appropriate data to evaluate the metals in groundwater at your site.
Great. Thank you, Bonnie, Brady, and Karen. Claudio, I believe this question you volunteered to respond to. Can you discuss how to address a site that has both, one, native soil, and two, unimpacted gravel used to construct roads and pads? The geology and metals concentration in the native soil and the gravel are very different.
Well, I'm not surprising that the gravel that is used for construction and the soil have very different concentration of inorganics. To me, you know, gravel could fit it as a sort of fuel for other type of construction, and we address that in section 2.2. And typically, is not used for you know, in the evaluation of anthropogenic ambient background. However, you have you check with your state agency that you're working with, because, for example, I remember that New Jersey and Massachusetts, I believe, they do consider historical fill as an anthropogenic ambient soil background condition. So again, it depends where you are, what kind of state agency you're working with, but, you know, generally speaking, you know, this is a fill material or like gravel, as you were describing, that is used for construction, is not used in this comparison to soil background. If somebody else wants to chime in that they have different experience, please do.
You must have done a great job with that answer, Claudio, as no one else is jumping in. So let's jump to another one here. So it starts with a statement in order to get to the question. So organisms evolve to suit their environment based on numerous stressors. but there is considerable variance in naturally occurring background concentrations. This means slight exceedances of naturally occurring BTVs are not necessarily harmful. Is there a rule of thumb to determine the magnitude of exceedances above a BTV that might be considered acceptable?
I'll start that out, and maybe others would like to chime in too. This is Bonnie. This is a really detailed question, and the guidance is really intended to just be an overall of how to establish background and how to use it in risk assessment. So to answer that question, you'd really need to go to your specific site that you're evaluating and look at everything. You'd really need to get into that site-specific evaluation. So I don't think there's really one answer that we could give you regarding that. But whatever your criteria is that your agency uses of an exceedance is an exceedance. It's going to definitely depend on your site-specific situation. If there may be cases where you might exceed, but it is not really what it looks like too. But go ahead, Karen.
Yeah, thank you, Bonnie. I was just going to say, yeah, that's a great question, and it's a complicated question. And I'll tackle the part, it says this means slight exceedances of naturally occurring BTVs or UTL 9595s are not necessarily or likely to be harmful. And that's where, and I think the guidance speaks to this, mere exceedance of a BTV indicates a potential problem, but it's not proof of a problem. So another shameless plug, if it's metals we're talking about, perform a geochemical evaluation to confirm if the concentrations that exceed the BTV actually do reflect site impacts. So that would be one route I would go.
Well, another thing that I picked up in the question, the person asked about was referring to organisms. So it may also be focusing on ecological receptors. And to me, while the exceedance may show that you have contamination, you also have, in the phase of remedy selection, you have to evaluate how much the disruption of the ecosystem itself would be more harmful than addressing a localized and relatively small exceedance. Again, that is a much more complicated question. It depends on individual organisms and their ability to adapt and the overall, how the ecosystem for that specific site is impacted.
Great. I think we're going to go with one more question before we end the training today. And so the question here is, should a logarithmic value like soil pH be converted to a concentration before completing background statistical evaluations?
And this is Bonnie, and others might want to chime in, but we really just don't get into that great of detail in the guidance. We offer how to establish soil background and some statistical processes that you can use. We really defer a lot of things that are a lot of detail to other guidance documents that you can look at, but that is probably something that you might want to discuss with your regulator or look at your specific regulator's guidance to find out what they suggest or what they recommend or what they require that you do. I know that a lot of people have a lot of different opinions sometimes on some of these things, statistical wise, that you can do. And so that's really probably going to be both a site specific and a regulatory agency specific question rather than a general guidance question. But I'm curious if anybody else in the panel has any kind of answer for that also, or if has had any experience with that.
Yeah, I'll just say I agree with everything you said, Bonnie. I think mathematically it makes more sense to do that. There are some ways of addressing it in log scale, but you have to use all log methods to do it, which can just be a little confusing. So yeah, we don't address it more straightforward to convert it, but there are ways of doing it.
Great. I'm going to pause us here and thank our trainers for today. This was the first training on the soil background and risk document produced by ITRC in December of 2021. We will be sharing the four videos that have been produced by the team as well. They will be located on the ITRC website in association with the guidance document, as well as on the ITRC YouTube video. And I hope that you are all members of the ITRC mailing list, and you will receive communications when those are posted final here in the coming days. Additionally, I put in the chat the link to the class page where you can find the feedback form. We would love to hear your feedback and information on the class, as well as at the bottom right-hand corner, there is a checkbox that you can click and you will be emailed a certificate of completion for the class today. And with that, I want to thank everybody for attending. Please continue to help spread the word on both ITRC guidance documents and ITRC trainings. We will be taking a hiatus this summer and we'll be back in the fall with more live trainings. Trainers, great job. Thank you, everybody, and have a great rest of the day.